This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. In the Drink is the show that brings you the most interesting beverage professionals, from sommeliers and winemakers. You know, we're really focusing more on wine these days, and we have a great wine director, a great beverage director in-house today. His name is Jared Roth. And before we get started, I do want to give a little bit of a plug to my own wines, Annona Wine. You can find more about them at annonawine.com. I make some great organic wines in Italy. You can find them at such great establishments as Fowler and Wells. Oh, wait a second. Jared is the beverage director at Fowler and Wells. Welcome to the studio. It's good to have you today.
Nice plug. Thank you.
I figured I'd plug both of us at the same time. Why not? Jared has a huge amount of experience at some of the best restaurants here in New York, including Hearth, including Gotham Bar and Grill, including Bobby Flay's Bar Americain. And now he is the beverage director, as I said, at Fowler and Wells, which might be the prettiest restaurant in the prettiest hotel in New York. It's like just a stunning place. Congratulations.
Thanks, man.
On the opening. You guys recently opened, right?
Yeah, we got all of the spaces up and running last fall. The ballroom, which is kind of the focal point of the hotel itself, with the soaring nine-story atrium, opened up in September of last year, just after Labor Day. And then the dining room, Fowler and Wells, we opened in late October. And then all of the meal periods finally came online earlier this year with the inclusion of brunch and lunch and all those things. So
yeah, I didn't want to sell you short, actually. You're the beverage director for the bar room as well, right?
Yes. Yeah, so we...
How does that work out?
Tom Colicchio's company, Crafted Hospitality, we do all the food and beverage for the hotel, the two dining spaces, the ballroom and Fowler and Wells, plus the four, soon to be six, event spaces and all the in-room dining. So... the kitchen team oversees the culinary aspect, and then I oversee the beverage components to it. And I don't do it all on my own. I do have some phenomenal help there as well.
Yeah, I noticed a familiar name. I was looking at your wine list. Claire Paparazzo is working with you? I didn't realize that. She's an old friend.
Yeah, Claire's she came on board in November through a connection with our director of operations. They worked together at Dirty French, and she kind of fell into our laps, wasn't really digging her current role, and just kind of wanted to come on board and be part of a team and contribute to something pretty new and leave her thumbprint on it. And she's been fantastic to have. I mean, we've achieved pretty early success with our service and beverage service, in part due to her experience. So it's been
and for those
cool.
of you guys who aren't familiar with Claire, she also has an impressive resume, including being the wine director of Blue Hill in the city. So just an impressive wine team.
She actually opened the original Blue Hill at Stone Barns as wow. their events director. And then when she left, I think they replaced her with like three different people.
Jeez, yeah. You need three people. And not to give Brooks Fraser and Jamel Freeman, your other two wine captains who I don't know so well, but I'm sure they're equally as awesome, too.
They are. Jamel came to us through an old Hearth connection through my buddy Nick Ferrante, who's at the Breslin. Jamel came on board in October and has been a huge part of the team, has shown, you know, great growth and strides. But I will say that the most important person on that page is definitely Brooks Frazier, who's a very good friend of mine. And I was able to entice her to leave Gramercy Tavern and to come on board as basically the number two, you know, de facto assistant beverage director. And she's incredibly talented, very organized, is very graceful on the floor and runs, you know, service from the beverage mm-hmm. standpoint on most nights. My role there is during the day, very administrative as far as beverage goes, but once service begins, it's much more managerial as far as overseeing the service as a whole. So to have people like Claire, Brooks, and Jamel to just take care of the beverage component is a huge relief.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about your past experience. And you've worked for some just major important chefs, Bobby Flay, Alfred Portale, Marco Canora, and now Tom Colicchio. And most of these chefs, I guess with the exception of Alfred Portale, is really focused on that one restaurant. And it's, I think, probably Gotham has more New York Times stars than any restaurant ever, I imagine. The consistent, like...
It's got to be up there. I think it's got 15 5-3-star reviews in its lifetime. It's pretty amazing. Unheard of.
But with each of these restaurants that you worked at, were you able to kind of figure out or distill what a management philosophy is that maybe came from the chef or from the group? Or a lot of times was it individual to the restaurant itself? And then how does that affect the way that you manage these very talented professionals that you're working with?
I would say the managerial component at its core started with my dad and growing up and someone who was a VP at a company that he and my family have owned and had in the family for 70 plus years. And
what kind of company is that? What do they do?
It's a business-to-business printing, laminating, binding product company called Spiral Binding Company that my grandfather helped to bring up, and then eventually my father and two uncles took it over in the late 70s, early 80s, and you know, ran it until continue to run it. They actually just sold it, so I know they're all very relieved.
Congratulations.
About that. Yeah, thanks. I know the family's happy to have that off their plate. But just growing up and listening to him talk about certain things that he would do every day and having to deal with unions and having to deal with people, as I got into management, all these things kind of started to come back to me a little bit. And the dealing with the beverage component, the invoices, things like that, that's all fairly easy. You know, bottles of wine don't really talk back. They don't show up late. It's all pretty straightforward, black and white in front of you. It's the management of people, which always presents the greatest challenge mm-hmm. because everyone is different. Everyone is at a different level of experience. Everyone's at a different level of emotional capacity and maturity. And on a daily basis, that's consistently the toughest thing. From where I was 10 years ago to now, I think is a huge, you know, 180 from understanding that and to seeing.
Right, because you had an early managerial experience at Bar Americaine, yep. being the assistant wine director. That I assume that's what you're referring to back in 2006, right? 11 years ago now.
It was that for the first time, and making that leap from being a captain with a team that I'd worked with for a year into a managerial role was definitely a difficult transition. You know, my tendencies were to still do the job of a captain for them. But I remember my GM, Mark Shea, at the time at Bar Americaine, pulling me outside in the middle of a service and, you know, saying that you can't do their job for them. They're never going to respect your new role if you continue to do your old role. And so your role now is to make sure that they are doing their job correctly, but not for you to do it for them. And that was probably the first lesson of moving up that I learned in terms of management things.
I'm sure that was a corrective that he was really happy to be giving you, because usually when you're like telling someone who you're managing, like, hey, you need to do more things and do them better and more quickly, but instead to you they're like, hey, you need to hold off and let other people do their job.
Yeah, I mean, my tendencies in any position, whether it was as a captain, a bartender, or a manager, is to jump in immediately and to be involved and to kind of feel things out in that regard. I would say that most of the management lessons I learned early in my career were as a result of not ideal situations. In a perfect world, you can walk away from any experience with something, whether it was, you know, how to do something or how not to do something. And so after leaving Bar Americana, a lot of those growth experiences were based on, you know, seeing how things were done and trying not to do it that way. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I got to Hearth in early 2009 that I had the opportunity to work with Paul Greco there and Marco, but with Paul more directly in the front of the house, and really started to hone in on some of the finer points of management and people and how to deal with
people.
But now,
when you started at Hearth, you took a step back, right?
Yes.
In order to move forward ultimately. But was that a hard decision for you to, I know you started at Hearth as a server or bartender, and to go from management, and you were even overseeing a program before that, a wine program at Apiary, right? Before Hearth. Mm-hmm. So was that, what was that like? That must have been humbling in a way.
It was an interesting transition. After leaving Bar Americana, had taken a stretch of a few different positions that didn't make me feel like hospitality and restaurants were the path that I was going to take in life. Mm. It had me question that. I thought about going into the family business, and even though it didn't speak to me on a passionate level, I knew it was something that would be comforting as far as having peace of mind and consistency as far as salary and work for the next 25, 30, 45 years or so.
And there's something nice about continuing on a family tradition, a family business, right?
There is. Those were the things that were attractive to me. But at the end of the day, there was nothing that I really enjoyed about that work. And I found myself, when I would work there part-time, really missing the hands-on approach and the human interactions of hospitality and restaurants. And so I was in a string of management and beverage positions that, again, weren't really providing any kind of satisfaction or growth. So I made a decision to go back to school with the intention of finishing my BA, which I did not do, because I went to big university and was immature and had a little too much fun. And at the same time, go back to serving and bartending. And so that's when the opportunity to work at Hearth came up. And so, as I was telling you before we started, when Paul and I sat down to interview, his biggest question was whether or not I would be comfortable not being in charge, not being responsible for day-to-day decisions. And for that period of my life, the answer was absolutely. I mean, I wasn't looking to do anything besides show up, contribute as best I can, and then to, you know, go on my studies and see what happened. But it was at Hearth at that time with Paul and Marco where, you know, this kind of fire got relit and I saw that you could have a lot of fun and it was very education driven and experience driven and they took care of their people and it was all about the food, the drink, and the hospitality, and it totally resonated with me.
Amazing. And so during that time there, do you think that your love for wine, I mean, Paul is such a magnetic personality. Did that also kind of re-spark your love for wine as well as for hospitality? Or had that kind of never gone away?
The desire to learn more about wine and beverage had never really gone away. I guess it had kind of lie dormant since leaving Bar Americana, and the first mentor I had there, Adam Rieger, I had kind of bitten off more than I could chew in the positions after that. So getting back and opening that wine list the first day at Hearth and seeing all of those pages and all of those wines. I mean, it was like total sensory overload.
It's amazing.
And it provided this drive to rededicate and to learn more, and eventually have this voice in my head, which still carries with me today, of, you know, what would Paul do? What would Paul say if he saw things in service? And even as crazy as how things are written out on a wine list and presented. So those are, you know, things that I still carry and certain attention to details and things like that.
So would you say he's like an early mentor or a mid career mentor in a way, or just a real inspiration?
I think a little bit of both. Mentor for sure. Definitely the most influential on my approach to service and hospitality and beverage and, you know, even the way you make selections and look at producers and approach tasting wine, you know, having this matrix in your head of quality and price and, you know, grape-specific character or terroir character, things like that. Really looking at it in a technical, broken-down manner, not technical as in, like, the court approach, but, you know, fitting into these different pieces.
Yeah. I like that approach as well, because, you know, something I would think about as a tasting wine, you taste, like, a Suave, and you're like, all right, if I'm going to have a Suave on the list, I've got to have the best one for the price for my guests. And, you know, and there's so many out there. And, sure, sometimes, I guess, you make decisions that are a little bit more practical, where you're like, all right, you know, I'm ordering from this person anyway. Maybe I like that Suave just a scotch more, or it costs just a, you know, a dollar less a bottle. So, but I'll still order from the other one because it's still a good wine. But trying to really maximize that, it sounds like that's what he was doing, like the best wine for the best price.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there were certain instances, you know, one of his approaches is that you don't typically just have one of something. You provide a spectrum for people to taste and to take notice of. So if we ever put together a selection or an area of wine that wasn't necessarily covered previously, you wouldn't just take one red from the Jura or Arbois. You would Jura Savoie. You would, you know, put together four or five selections that show the range of wines and different grapes and things like that. And it's something that, you know, is important for me, both as a buyer and consumer and, you know, educator, for staff and for us especially, is to make sure that if we're going to talk about sherry, that we have the whole spectrum to offer, so that you can take a guest or take your staff through, you know, all the different styles and what is represented from that region. To just have one of something for the sake of having it, it's not, you know, to each his own, but that's not how, you know, we do it.
Yeah. And now your next, so during your time there, you did change your roles, right? You moved up in, from what I remember, you also built a lot of the cocktails and the bar program there. What was the progression like there?
Yeah, there was a lot of opportunity offered and afforded to me in my time there. Quickly after starting, I realized that, you know, the family business was definitely not for me. That,
however, my, exciting the laminating paper B2B sales go,
exactly.
Like, it is, sounds very alluring.
I did learn to drive a forklift, which is something that you really, you know, you always need in life, to be able to drive a forklift, move crates, things like that.
Did it beep when you went reverse?
Absolutely.
Oh, that sounds pretty cool.
I knocked over a few things the first time. but I realized that the hospitality industry was really where my passion lied, and that someone would pay me to do this job was always a big lure for me. When I was in school still at the time, Paul had offered to have me work at Tawari's Village, which I wasn't really into because it was much later nights. And then some of the other terroirs opened up, an opportunity to be on those teams were offered. But I was very clear on what I wanted, which was to oversee the wine list at Hearth eventually. And so the first step after being a captain there was to move behind the bar. And then shortly thereafter, both bartenders left. One of them in particular, Vince Favella, was a huge influence on my bar and cocktail knowledge. To this day, he remains one of the two most knowledgeable bartenders I've ever worked with. And he provided me a good foundation and allowed me to get comfortable behind that space before he took off. And then myself and our operations manager, David Flaherty, oversaw the spirits and cocktail list for about a year and a half there until a management opportunity presented itself. And in that time, I also did some floor som work there on the occasional Friday and Saturday night, and really had my hands in a lot of different aspects of the operation.
Yeah. It's amazing how in the restaurant industry, I feel like people move so frequently that if you just show up and do your job and do a good job every day, eventually there's going to be an opening for you to move up. It just kind of happens. So you're like, okay, who's still here and is good at their job? Oh, like, let's move them up. Especially if there's like some like outward showing of like enthusiasm or interest in, you know, in moving up. But there are opportunities in this industry just by staying where you are a lot of times.
Yeah. And I think that is not the most frequent approach by a lot of people. One, showing up and doing your job, as I've learned, is not, you know, first and foremost on most people's minds, which is an amazing thing considering it's how you make your living. You don't show up, or you just, you know, it's pretty inconsistent. That's one of the things I've learned in this hotel space. But
is it union? Is it a union situation?
It's not union, but because we have such a large staff and we have so many meal periods, staffing for the early, like, breakfast,
lunch, dinner,
right? But staffing, especially for breakfast, is turned into a major challenge. And so we'll hire someone and we'll say, you know, just so you know, the call time on a daily basis is 6 a.m. They say, yeah, of course I can do that. I want to work AMs. And, you know, a week in, 2 weeks in, they're showing up half hour late, 45 minutes late, no call, no show. So there's a lot of different things that you know, present those challenges. Again, just getting back to the management of people. But I got off track, as per usual.
And on that note, it seems like that Roberta's has turned into a construction site. So I think it's a good time for us to take a quick break. We'll be back more with Jared Roth, who is the beverage director of both Fowler and Wells and the bar room at the gorgeous Beekman Hotel, right after this.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hi, I'm Carrie Diamond, host of Radio Cherry Bomb, the show about women and food on Heritage Radio Network. Tune in on Thursdays at 1 p.m. to hear interviews with the most interesting women in the world of food. Support our show and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate. The sun went down. My hopes began to rise up above.
All right, we're back with Jared Roth, who runs the beverage program at Fowler and Wells and the bar room at the Beekman Hotel. Beautiful, beautiful restaurants with outstanding beverage programs. I wanted to ask you, on the first page of your wine list, you have a quote from William Shakespeare, of all people. Good company, good wine, good welcome can make good people. Can you tell us about the inspiration for the quote, why you have it on the wine list?
Of course. Admittedly, I have only read 2 Shakespeare books in my life, so I am by no means an authority on good old Bill. But I found the quote to be very applicable to what we do and to the space itself, as if you've been into the space, the feeling is that as soon as you walk in, you feel you're transported back to the Victorian era of London or of old New York, where if you looked around the room, you could see Cornelius Vanderbilt or any of the robber barons having something to drink and smoking a cigar and talking about the markets and things of that nature. It's a very transportational space, and I think that the idea of providing company and food and drink and revelry is something that can put people in a really positive and jovial frame of mind. And so that's kind of where the quote, the impetus for choosing the quote comes from, is to kind of just get people in that joyous frame of mind for being in the space and drinking and eating and having fun.
Yeah, I like this aspect, can make good people, because it's something we were chatting about earlier, but I fully believe, like, you have the ability, if someone's had a crummy day, to make it an incrementally or maybe significantly better day by a smile and something delicious.
For sure. The old adage when, as you said, when we were talking, is that if someone comes in and you're reading the body language and they're miserable, maybe they got let go of, or they got into a fight, or the day's just not going as they planned, there are opportunities for us to change that and to provide a positive experience, whether the service is really engaging and talkative, or you just go about the service and execute it properly, and then provide some really good food and drink, and maybe a specific pairing really hits it on the head for that person, and they're immediately brought back to a trip that they took years ago to Piemonte or to the south of France or something like that, and so they feel transported to a time of pure happiness. And in that moment they realize that everything is going to be okay, or that at least in that moment they're happier than they were 5 minutes ago. And so in that regard, we've mission accomplished.
Yeah. Now, I guess this is a show about wine and beverage, so I guess we should talk about that too. I really love your wine list. One of the things that I noticed, especially in the By the Glass selections, is a focus on some New York State wines. And what I thought, I don't know if this is what went through your head, and I'd like to find out, is, did you do that because it's a hotel, you're getting a lot of people coming internationally or even across the country? Maybe you want to show, hey, this is kind of what we do in New York too. Is that where that's come from?
That's definitely one of the drivers behind it. There's a couple of different factors though. Getting back to my assistant beverage director, Brooks, she's a huge proponent of New York wines. Mm-hmm. And was very adamant about having them on the list from day one. It took a little while, but I think we have 5 or even maybe 6 now. Also, coming from Hearth and working with Paul, there was always a focus on showing off what the state was capable of. And
he's such a big fan of Riesling.
For sure.
And that's, I think, probably, in my opinion, the best thing we can do in New York State, right?
I think it's the best white wine that we make as a country is New York State Riesling.
Wow.
I would take that, some Herman Wehmer Magdalena Vineyard, over anything else.
So good. I agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they just purchased a big plot of land, right? Or an old winery. I can't remember the details, but they are in an expansion mode, and I think that's good news for everyone.
Yeah, Fred and Oscar are always pushing forward, and I think are the drivers of the Finger Lakes in general, but of New York wine as a whole. But for us, we wanted to do both. As you mentioned, we have a hotel, lots of international guests coming through, lots of people from other parts of the United States who may not be exposed to New York wine coming through. And while I don't think that everything that the state produces is great, I do think that the Finger Lakes and the North Fork do have a handful of producers which are absolutely worth highlighting and showing off. Mm-hmm. We want to show off some different styles, some wines that were more terroir-driven versus stylistically or winemaker-driven. I think like the Channing Daughters Rosé is a great example of a winemaker-driven wine. James Christopher Tracy is a partner and winemaker there. And the wines, I was first exposed to those years ago at Blue Water Grill. But the wines that he makes, I think, are totally, totally fascinating. Some of them in a terroir way, terroir-driven way, but I also think that he has a very creative mind and blends certain things together that just work in a very harmonious way. And so the Risotto de Cabernet Sauvignon was something that we really liked and had a cool story behind it. And again, at the end of the day, when tasting and looking at that price matrix, it represents a place, it represents a style or a personality. It's priced right and it's damn delicious.
That is good. I like that he also pushes the envelope, does a lot of experiments, and is always trying something new, right? I remember, I don't know if it's still this case, you've been in a buying position more recently than I have, but I remember, I think one year he did 6 different rosés, like a couple, like maybe three like single grapes, and then 3 blends or something like that.
He makes a lot of different wines. He always, not always, but he usually does like a Ramato style.
Oh, yeah.
And then he's always doing some you know, Friulian whites like the Meditazione, and some interesting reds where he's blending Lemberger and Merlot. So it's, again, he's like you said, pretty, always pushing the envelope and some creative stuff. And we also are huge fans of the Bedell Cellars. Their Blanc de Blanc from the North Fork, I think, is a great representation of what North Fork fruit can do, you know, when gone through the classical method and shows, you know, great salinity and representation of being situated between two different, you know, parts of the Atlantic.
Yeah. And what was your approach to the rest of the list? I mean, other than just like page after page of truly delicious wine that I'm excited to drink, how did you approach? You have a huge champagne selection. I want to also ask you about your dessert wines. That's on my mind because that's something that I've always found very hard to sell. Let's tackle that first because that sure. Seems like an easier question. You have quite a bit of like sweet and fortified wines, which I think is brave. I think is awesome. I found it hard to sell as someone who's selling wine, but I would certainly drink you know, any of these wines that are on your list. Why was that something of a focus? Is that something of a passion of yours?
It's both. I think it is necessary to provide the ultimate well-rounded dining experience, which is ideally, you know, a cocktail first, then into a bottle of champagne, white wine, red wine, and then you finish with sweet wine, and then you have a digestif, whether an Amari or a Calvados or something like that.
So, I want to eat with you because that sounds like fun. That sounds
go full circle, and you know, it's indulgent, but sometimes you just got to cut loose and run the spectrum.
And are people doing that? Are people eating in that way? Or
maybe not as indulgent as that, but you know, we have people who come in and they, you know, we'll do some version of that. You know, Sauternes, I think, is the most recognizable name on any sweet wine list. I'm more partial to Alsace, Baron Alsace, you know, the sweeties from Riesling, and then sweets from Chenin Blanc. I like the acid component. I think it provides a little bit more lift and freshness on the wines. But again, just as for me, though it may be repetitive, all roads kind of lead back to my experience at Hearth. I think that a well-rounded beverage program doesn't just offer great bottles of wine, but it offers great glass offerings. And what you offer by the glass needs to be a snapshot of what is in the rest of the list. So if someone has this great experience with cocktails and then a bottle of wine and the food is fantastic and then they get the dessert and you only have one sweet wine to offer, to me that it kind of, you know, the experience just drops off a cliff.
Right.
And so whether or not anyone ever comes in and orders that rare Pedro Jimenez for 100 a pour, it's not going to go bad. I don't really give a shit. We just want to have it on there.
It's not going to go bad. You could probably have one bottle and that's
be good for a while.
Indestructible.
Yeah.
Right?
Same thing with the Madeiras.
Yeah.
Though we do sell a fair amount of Madeira in the space.
It feels like a good space to drink Madeira.
For sure. It's that old timey feel.
Yeah. Oh, that totally makes sense. They have some cool old Madeiras. Oh, that's super exciting. Okay, so for the rest of the list, what was the approach? I mean, it's just tons of great wine, a little bit of a focus on Old World, but certainly some amazing New World wines as well. How did you put this together?
In conversations with Tom and Brian Hunt, who's our executive chef of the hotel, and then with other members of the Crafted team in moving into this project, the space itself really dictated what we were going to do, both from a culinary standpoint and from a beverage standpoint. It didn't really make a lot of sense to be serving this classic stock and sauce-based food with Argentinian wines and Chilean wines,
right,
and Australia. They all have their place in the beverage and food world. But for us, everything felt very classic, very old school, very Old World driven. So we wanted to make sure that we focused on the classic regions of Europe, Austria and German whites, some reds just for fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then Northern Rhone and Burgundy and Bordeaux. And then, some other pockets of France, Spain, Italy, a lot of Northern Italian selections.
Great Burgundy selection too. Just
thanks,
like,
man.
And like really cool. You can find some older vintages. That's like, and I love stuff like this, like the Michel Ganot 08 Côte de Beaune, just like the bone for, $100 to find something from like a great producer, has some age to it. Maybe I'm not usually spending $100 on when I go out to, drink wine, but like, that's so cool. I'm going to spend a little bit more because like, you don't find stuff like that around.
Right. It's got some age and it's got, a great producer behind it. We were very fortunate when we went to open the restaurant that we had some reserve wine that was purchased years ago and then put into storage from, Craft Bar. And then, though it was not a good thing, we unfortunately had to close Colicchio & Sons in the fall of last year.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, between Ryan and Patrick Bennett, they put together a phenomenal cellar, and we were able to kind of look at that and pick and choose what we wanted to round out what had already been purchased and planned out. Mm. So we had access to a lot of old Piedmontese, a lot of Riesling with some age, a lot of, Burgundy gems here and there. And then as a whole, the approach as far as pricing structure was to make it accessible for anyone that would walk in, whether it was a family visiting from the UK or from New Zealand and was comfortable spending $50 or $60 on a bottle, or a guy from Europe who wanted to come in and drink some blue chip Burgundy or some first growth Bordeaux.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunity is there for both.
And that's the hard thing to do. Like, if you're starting a brand new restaurant, to be able to, here comes the construction, to be able to have a deep cellar with good vintages and see like on some of these like cool finds, the markup is pretty reasonable. That's so hard. So what a treat that you're able to work with that.
The goal at the end of the day is in an ideal world to have a bottle on every single table.
Yeah.
I would always rather have a $75 or $80 bottle on every table than $400 or $500 bottles. I think that the domino effect always takes place when people see and they walk into a restaurant and the first five tables they see all have a bottle, or they all have a giant steak for two or a seafood tower, that those things influence the way you purchase when you go to sit down, because now your eyes are peering back and it's kind of that keeping up with the Joneses mentality. I want what they're having over there. That looks awesome. Let's do that.
As we're talking, I'm just putting some like restaurant history puzzle pieces together. And I think that this is accurate, but correct me if I'm wrong. So Tom Colicchio and Paul Greco worked together at Gramercy Tavern.
Correct. It goes back a little further, but they did work together there along with Marco Canora.
And Marco worked at Gramercy Tavern too.
Correct.
And then Tom opened up Kraft, and Marco worked at Kraft.
Correct. And then Marco and Paul, Marco left Kraft, and Marco and Paul opened up Hearth together and had a pretty substantial run there. But even going further back, Tom cooked at Gotham with Alfred Portale in two different iterations. I think, and my dates and timeline may be off here, but I believe he cooked there in the mid-'80s when Gotham opened. and was offered a soup position and then left. I believe he went to the Quilted Giraffe and then came back to Gotham before going to open Mondrian and then to open Gramercy with Danny. Mm. And at Gramercy, there was this pretty incredible lineup of people who passed through both the front of the house and the back of the house. I mean, our executive chef Brian worked there. Marco and Paul met there. Robert Bohr worked there. Fred Dexheimer worked there. Jonathan Benno, and then moving on to Claudia Fleming was the pastry chef there. I mean, she's like one of the great American pastry chefs.
Yeah.
And then moving on to Kraft, that kitchen, David Chang worked there. Akhtar Nawab worked there. Sisha worked there, who with Tom created and opened up the Witchcraft brand. So it's
kind
a
of
pretty
all
cool
roads
lineage.
Lead back to Gramercy and Kraft and like those restaurants and those. It's amazing.
Yeah, as far as this world goes.
And you've worked for a lot of these people separately. I mean, is there some like through line, something that they all do that makes sense, or have they all really kind of like gone their separate ways with their approaches to restaurants?
I think they've all kind of taken their own personal approach to things. When I left Hearth, there were really only two places that I was interested in working, or two groups. One of them was at Gramercy specifically, not even really for Union Square, though it's a phenomenal company. But at Gramercy specifically, and then at Kraft or with Crafted. I had, and Gotham as well. I had been fortunate enough to spend the summer of 2013 working on the floor there as a SOM while they transitioned when Eric Zillier was leaving, mm-hmm. and the current wine director Heidi was coming in. Was able to work with her and you know, be part of that transition, which was a really phenomenal experience. And then left to do Harvest, and then they offered me the service director position before leaving, which I took. But it eventually led me to River Park, which is part of Crafted. And I guess getting back to your question, the thing that Hearth and Crafted really spoke to me about, and Gramercy as well, though to a lesser extent because I never worked there, was they all take care of their people really well. And not just their managers or upper managers, but their staff as a whole, from dishwasher porter to sommelier to bartender to GMs and everything in between. They're companies that pride themselves on making sure their people are satisfied. Because as one of Gramercy's tenants, if your staff is satisfied and taken care of, then your guests in turn will be satisfied and taken care of.
Can you think of something that is more, an experience where you saw like, oh, that's really good taking care of the people. Like, is it just like being nice to them and treating them well, or is there something beyond that?
I think on a daily basis, it's just general kindness and comfort, allowing your staff to know that they will show up to work every day with a safe environment to be in, not just physically safe from harm, but mentally safe as well from harassment and things of that nature. Making sure that your staff knows that you have their back on a daily level through guest experience, guest interactions. Unfortunately, there are guests who feel that they are better than the staff and they're condescending and rude, and I'm sure you've dealt with it in your time in restaurants as well. And whether right or wrong, it's important to step forward and say, like, you know, you can't speak to my guys like this. You can't speak to people in general, but not to this crew. So on a daily level, I think that's really important, and it provides your staff with a sense of comfort. Making sure that your checks go through every week is huge. I've worked at places and have had friends who work at places where, the check doesn't go through for a couple of weeks, and it's a dicey situation. I mean, that's kind of a writing on the wall thing. You should get out when you start to see that stuff.
Yeah. Going back to your like not treating people well. I remember it's happened more when I was at Babbo, but someone might treat a server very poorly, and then I'd come over wearing a suit as a sommelier, and they'd be like, "Oh, what's going on?" And, like, try to be really cool. I'm like, no.
Yeah.
Like, the server is actually has way more experience than I do, is better at what she does than I am, and is making more money than I am. Plus, just don't treat anyone poorly.
Don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick. That's rule number one. So you were kind of, you're speaking a little bit about some, you know, I've heard from anyone who works in a hotel that it's hard to staff for, you know, breakfast. And, but what about young sommeliers? I've heard some grumblings from a couple of people that, there's like a new crop of sommeliers. I think we're about the same age, mm-hmm. and, you know, but like this new crop of sommeliers, maybe some of them aren't as, focused or ambitious, or maybe they just want to like move up quickly. I mean, as someone who's like really put their time in, at some places and even took a step back to eventually take, you know, a step forward, which seems really smart to me, what advice do you have to young sommeliers? Are you seeing people that kind of have like this millennial itch to like move quickly? Or
I think there's always what I've noticed going back a few years is the idea that the grass is always greener on the other side. This next position is going to be the right position for me. And what I really learned from taking a step back and going to Hearth was that oftentimes it's about the company. And who you're going to work for more so than what the job title is itself. Because I was 26, 27 when I left Bar American and took a beverage director position in management, thinking that I was prepared and I had, you know, done this for a year and I can do this and this is the next position for me. And the company was not good. They didn't take care of their people. They weren't fun to work with. They weren't, even if they weren't fun, they were not, didn't provide any kind of inspiration. So it became clear to me that, it's more about, you know, the company itself or the restaurant as a whole than just the position. It's one of the reasons why I went to work at Gotham for a year, even though it wasn't in a beverage capacity, it was in a service capacity, was because it's a great restaurant. And has an incredible history to it, an incredible influence on the New York and national landscape of food and hospitality. That's a huge thing for me is picking the right company.
Mm-hmm. And you're working once again with with a Gotham alum.
We have a few Gotham alums. Brandon Lynn, who was the director of operations at Gotham for 7 years, is now our director of food and beverage for the hotel. Which is really fantastic to work with him. Stephen Bloom, who's our assistant general manager, was a longtime captain at Gotham and even had a quick cup of coffee at Hearth for a few months. And Julia Griesman, who's one of our food and beverage managers, also a former Gothamite as well. So
I say it all the time, but it even in like the New York restaurant world, which is such... There's so many restaurants. I don't know how many tens of thousands of restaurants are in New York. In the really good restaurants, like the ones that you've worked at, it's such a small world. You see how many people you're working with now who you've worked with in the past, and that's ultimately how you can live or die in this industry by the relationships you have, the job you do while you're there, and recognizing that it's a small world. And don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick. Don't burn bridges. Treat people kindly, because, again, you never know you're going to walk into a place for a job application or for an interview and you're going to sit down in front of someone that you told to go, you know, F off. Can we say fuck on the radio?
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone you told to go fuck
regulated
off.
By. We're at Roberta's.
Yeah, so we can say whatever the fuck we want.
Yeah, actually, we're going to have pizza after this, right?
Totally.
A couple of weeks ago, I was sitting down and had some pizza with a guest, and the server had a t-shirt on that said, fuck Roberta's.
Oh, the sweet irony of being here.
Isn't that great? Jared, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. Good first experience on the radio.
It's your first one.
Yeah.
You killed it. You got to have you back.
Thanks, dude.
Guys, if you haven't been, I highly recommend going to Fowler and Wells and to the bar room and seeing the most beautiful, I think the most beautiful bar in most beautiful hotel that I've ever been to, and having some of Jared's delicious drinks and the great food over there as well. I do want to let you guys know that our next show is not going to be live. Usually the show airs live at 11 a.m. on Wednesdays, but we are going to tape it later tonight and we'll air it next week. And it will be with Ian Dagata, who is an educator and author. He writes for Venice. He wrote a great book on native indigenous Italian grapes that I have all highlighted and a little bit tattered up because I keep referencing it. I love his work. So I'm really excited about that. And if you ever want to reach out, if you have any suggestions, questions, guest suggestions, you can reach out to me at joe@annonawine.com. That's annonawine.com. And why not subscribe? You could subscribe to the show and then you can just get it automatically uploaded to whatever you use to listen to podcasts. iTunes, Stitcher. Stitcher is a great way to do it too. You can try that out. And also, I think one last thing, become a member for Heritage. That's a good thing to do. I think it's tax deductible.
Support public radio.
Support public radio. Thank you, Jared. I agree with that. I want to thank Vitar, who produced the show today, everyone at Heritage Radio Network, and Haley Crane, who helped out with this episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. This has been In the Drink.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.